I'm Stephanie Overbeck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold. If you've listened to our show, you've probably heard us mention blockchain a few times. Blockchain is a distributed digital ledger that allows transactions to be recorded securely without relying on a centralized database. The most common use of this technology is to complete financial transactions between people without the oversight of a third party, such as a bank. Hence, the rise of digital currencies on the blockchain, most famously Bitcoin.
Blockchain is an incredibly powerful tool, but it's not without limitations. In order to record a transaction of any kind on blockchain, a computer must verify it with every other node on the entire blockchain network.
Think of it this way. If I want to give Mel a $10 bill, I don't need to know where every other dollar in the world is. I can just hand him the money. To send any amount of Bitcoin, however, a computer has to account for the entire universe of Bitcoin. This process must put a limit on the number of transactions that can happen on blockchain at any given second.
In this episode, we're speaking with Arthur Brock, chief architect of a new distributed digital ledger called Holochain. Rather than having to validate the data on the entire distributed network, agents on Holochain ensure the security of transactions through peer-to-peer enforcement of rules. The way, for example, cells in a body might recognize and regulate each other according to the rules of their DNA. This key difference makes Holochain scalable in ways blockchain is not. We ask Arthur how he sees this technology improving our collective intelligence to lead us to a more egalitarian and sustainable society.
Take a listen.
I'm Arthur Brock. I work in a strange field of currency design that many others don't necessarily recognize as currencies. I'll come back to that. But also a software architect and spending most of my energy right now on decentralized technology systems. Holochain in particular, maybe one that you have heard of. It's a scalable alternative to blockchain.
Let's start off with the Holochain. Can you talk, I don't know if most people actually have heard about blockchain, and it's becoming mainstream, and DeFi finance there are massive shifts currently in the market. You know, it's becoming, I guess, more and more mainstream, but probably not everyone has heard about blockchain yet, or maybe heard, but not really quite know what it is. What is it what is Holochain in comparison to blockchain?
So first, just a quick thing about what blockchain is. Many people may not have heard of blockchain, but most are now hearing about things like Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. And most of those cryptocurrencies all run on blockchain. That's the technology underneath or behind them for having them be decentralized. And without getting too technical, blocks and chain has to do with some of the architecture of it, like a hash chain of blocks of transactions. And Holochain also uses hash chain, also uses hashes and cryptography and all of this to basically ensure tamper-proof data when it's not being centrally hosted. But like the opportunity, I think, is more than just these currencies that blockchain has kind of popularized, but breaking data integrity from data control, right? Like we've collapsed them in the past. Like who wouldn't want to log into their bank account and change their balance, right? So in order to prevent that kind of control of the data, the banks have their servers behind, you know, layers of firewalls and high, you know, practically in a fort, in a castle, you know, like behind physical security and all that kind of stuff, and all kinds of procedures about who can make changes to these things, because otherwise fraudulent kinds of changes could occur. Well, Holochain is about basically unlocking that so that we can all hold our data and it can still be tamper-proof.
Well, let's go with that. So centralization versus decentralization as the core shift that is available to us now through this technology, how would it change life? What does it actually mean to go from centralized systems to decentralized systems? Maybe you could give a few examples.
Well, there's always power imbalances built into centralized systems. I mean, take even something like Google Docs or Google Spreadsheets or something like that. It has allowed ad hoc groups to come together and organize using this kind of infrastructure, right, as a shared type of platform, and yet it's centralized. So Google could always pull the plug. They could always discontinue the product. They could always say what you're doing doesn't meet their, you know, user requirements. And, you know, recent politics showing with Parler, Google pulling it from their app store, Apple pulling it from their app store, Amazon pulling it from their hosting. There's always this power imbalance in any centralized system. And there's always sysadmins that are essentially kind of gods, as opposed to regular people who operate inside of whatever constraints they're constrained to. So Holochain is really about flipping this completely on its head. It's completely peer-to-peer. So blockchain is not completely peer-to-peer. There are nodes that are sort of elevated status. They're known as miners or stakers or, you know, different things like this. In Holochain, essentially what you're doing is you're installing some software locally. And if you're using a browser for a UI, you're pointing the browser at localhost. You're pointing the browser at yourself, at your own machine. And then Holochain is kind of like the data engine behind it that weaves together data hosted by all these people that are hosting themselves. And it makes sure that the data is findable and reliably online, resilient, and tamper-proof through its hash chains and cryptographic data structures and that kind of stuff. So it allows us to, for example, take Facebook out of the middle of our social network interactions, or Twitter, or even Wikipedia. Not that Wikipedia is a you know, power-hungry organization, but all they're doing is providing a central place of hosting our own knowledge, right? We're all the producers of the value in these scenarios, and yet we basically have a surveillance corporation in the middle, most of whom have their revenue model based on spying on us and selling data about us to advertisers. And so what becomes possible really is whole new patterns of social organization. In fact, the way that I think about it is kind of like what became possible with the advent of DNA on the planet, right? DNA allowed cells to organize in new kinds of patterns, right? And in a decentralized way. There's not a boss cell. There's a pattern where each cell runs the same DNA, and they can kind of enforce rules against each other. So we have an immune system that does that and everything. And that's the way Holochain is structured. Holochain and all of our designs are basically patterned off of nature. And so Holochain has an immune system. And Holochain, we actually call your Holochain application your DNA. And every node in an application runs the same DNA, and therefore they can enforce the same rules against each other. So now everybody is operating under the same rules instead of this power imbalance of the people who control it and then everybody else, right?
I see. So if you're, just to kind of go back to the Facebook model, because we all know Facebook and we all understand what it's about. And if you really want to leverage the power of that Facebook or Google model, you basically have to compete for user, like, connections. You're trying to build a strong connection network, and then you become an influencer, and then you have real power over social organization. How would that be different under something like a Holochain network? Would everyone have their 20 million followers, or how does the experience of power and power dynamic change with a decentralized system like that?
Yeah, it's great. What you're pointing at is that there's actually some different dynamics in play. And a lot of people think they can get all of them, right? Like, I think that this has come out a little bit in the Parler hosting conversation, where people say, I want the freedom to do whatever the heck I want. And I want somebody else to just host it for free for me. And I'm going to call it free speech if they don't, you know, like, say it's a breach of free speech if they don't do it. But free speech is that you get to speak. It's not that I have to relay what you're speaking, or I have to host what you're speaking, or, right? And so there's these power trade-offs. And one of the things you're pointing to is reach, right, versus basically control or privacy, right? You get network effects by surrendering control over to these centralized things that have these big network effects. So you get a large reach, but you surrender the control of your data. If you read Facebook's, you know, terms, basically they own your data. If you post it there, you no longer own it. Now, you're still the author of it, and they can't prevent you from using it, but they have the right to use it. It's now their data. And so that means they can sell it to advertisers, they can do whatever, they can use it in their ads, use your photo in their ads, you know, like that kind of thing. So there's these places where there's dynamics of trade-off, and you have to choose which it is that you're going for. Not everybody's going for the audience of 2 million people. Like if you take something like Slack chat for a moment, right? You're not trying to reach 2 billion people, right? You are having a team of 25 people, 200 people max or something, you know, like there's larger Slack groups than that. But, you know, in that scenario, why wouldn't you choose to actually be in control of your data instead of turning it all over to a corporation?
Well, I met people who said, ask me why is this a problem, you know, to give up my data. And at that point, I'm so speechless. I give the word to you. Why is it so dangerous to give away your data?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. This, again, all of our models are built on patterning nature. And what I would assert is that even in nature, too much of a good thing becomes a bad thing. And what I mean by that is concentrations are toxic. So we spread manure on our fields to fertilize them because it's a good thing. But you go to a feedlot where all that manure is all captured too close together and it's toxic, right? Even water, which seems totally neutral and an absolute necessary ingredient for life on the planet, right? When it rains and can soak in, right, then it nourishes the life there. When it rains and floods and gets concentrated into a gully, it starts eroding the topsoil, right? So patterns of concentration are toxic. And I think part of the dynamic we're seeing, like, I don't know if you've seen the movie The Social Dilemma out on Netflix and that kind of thing. Part of the dynamic we're seeing is the backlash from toxic concentrations of data, where these organizations know too much about you and, you know things about you maybe before you know them about you or your family members or, you know, things like that. And the problem is that they use that knowledge for their profit, not for your benefit. So that's where the social dilemma comes in, you know, pointing to basically they want to keep you on, which means it works for them to serve you things that you're going to react strongly to, not that you necessarily are nourished by or inspired by. And so that starts leading us into these bubbles of divisiveness and echo chambers and that kind of stuff, which is totally destroying our political landscape. And it's just a side effect. They're not doing it on purpose, but this is part of what happens from the feedback loops that are encoded into these organizations.
I mean, when the internet came up, I think there was this big vision of the internet having real value, you know, of being a real service. And I think that is kind of, how should we say?
Well, it has been a real service, but the question is, it's been, how it's privatized, right? That's created it in a different way than was originally envisioned, I think, right?
Right. So when we come to Holochain, like how do you see, in the ideal future, how do you see what's your vision for the future? If you say, okay, everything has been built, whatever you want to build, how does it look like?
Well, first of all, Holochain is actually just an on-ramp to a larger technology vision that we have and that we've prototyped a number of parts of. It was called Ceptr, CEPTR. You can go to ceptr.org to see that kind of information. It's now called Coventina, the Coventina framework. We don't have a lot of information about it published under Coventina yet, though. And Holochain is an on-ramp to that, where we basically have implemented a couple of the paradigm shifts that we want to move toward with Ceptr, Coventina, which is essentially a whole rewrite of our communications currency and coordination, collaboration stack, computing. Those are the three C's. Sorry, computing, communication or coordination, collaboration, and currencies based on the patterns of nature. Because we have this problem of thinking that somehow our economies can be, you know, free of the laws of nature and the limitations of physics, and that we can just grow currency supplies independent of the, you know, the ecosystems that our economies function on top of. And but more than that, there's organizing principles in living systems in life and that type of stuff, which scale without centralized control. And Scepter is that larger picture. And so what that looks like as we move toward that is really, I mentioned before the thing about DNA, so with the rise of DNA, we had this Cambrian explosion of life forms, where life tried out lots of different shapes and sizes of organizing, right? And I see that similarly, a Anthropocene, a post-Anthropocene explosion of social DNAs, right? Of new ways that we can organize ourselves, not always in these hierarchical command and control extractive kind of structures, which are really carryovers from the industrial age, right? Like that was appropriate to that age, but now we're in a networked information age, and we can organize ourselves in much richer networked patterns, but we're still mentally and socially carrying the templates over from the industrial age, including in the realm of money and finance, where we have centrally controlled currencies. And that's the resistance to cryptocurrencies are like the first glimpse of decentralized stuff here, I think.
Well, I like the three C's, you know, like communications. I think we get a good clear picture of that. That's our Facebook, right, example. And there's many other applications, of course, but let's just go there. And then the second C is currency. And so often we always think of currency as money, but I think you're talking about a much broader idea of what currency means and as a tool. Could you elaborate a little bit about what the second C is? How is it relating to all of this?
Sure. Yeah. I use the word currency very differently than we kind of take it for granted in English, where we use it in an equivalent way to money. I define currency as a formal symbol system designed to shape, enable, or measure currents or flows, right? So money is a formal symbol system, right? We all get to create value. Value is an informal system. Money is a formalized one. If I create dollars, that's called counterfeiting. If a bank creates dollars, that's called a loan, right? So there's a formalized method around a currency, and there's a life cycle to these things where the units of currency start off through issuance, and then there's transaction rules, and there's interplays with other currencies, and then there's like redemption, retirement, expiration. That's the life cycle of tokens. There's also a system level above that that has its own life cycle, and that's where the secret kind of power is held, is in who controls the system that makes the rules about the tokens. The point of this, though, is really currencies. The way my little shorthand for all of this is like sort of scare quotes current or currents, C to C with the eyes, right? Like if you think of that hyphenated word, currency or currencies. It is the symbol systems we use to see things. And if you think about the intelligence encoded into our social organisms, our corporations, institutions, governments, those kinds of things that are steering by balance sheets and profit and loss and prices and right, like those kinds of things, you can actually see how it is part of the sensory system of these social organisms. There are other ones too, right? Like, because of where we are, we think that humans are born and that they die. But as far as the state is concerned, humans are issued through birth certificates and expired through death certificates, right? If you go into the DMV to get your driver's license, it doesn't matter even if the person behind the counter knows you and has known you your whole life. If you can't hand them a birth certificate, passport, driver's license from another state, that the state can see what entity it is that it's dealing with, which human was issued, right? Then you can't get the driver's license because it's part of this different level of sensory equipment. And so what this means about currencies is that currencies end up being these super powerful tools for hacking all of our social patterns, right? Currencies are a way that we can see a flow that we weren't there to witness, right? Like the receipt that you carry out the door of the store, if the security guard stops you, you know, is the proof that you bought the thing. The flow just occurred. And if I say, hey, that pen in your pocket, where did you get it? And I wasn't there when you got it, you know, like what proves where you got it is this record that we keep. So one of the other things is that currencies are kind of like the footprints, the tracks we leave behind to track flows that occurred. And those aren't always just monetary flows, right? The degree is tracking that a flow of learning occurred. And the full track, the more detailed tracks, is called your transcript, right? And that's going to record which classes you had with whom and how well you performed, right? And using the performance metric ones and the credits and these are all tools for collective intelligence and large scale orchestration. And in an information era, we need to develop fluency, I think, in these kinds of tools. So in the same way that writing and reading were so important in the industrial age, I actually think that currency design and the understanding and interpretation of these and understanding how to hack ourselves better with currencies is kind of a key form of literacy. I would call it fluency because it's about flows, right? Yeah. For the information age.
I mean, There's so much creativity that could come out of that.
Yeah, well, it has already come out of it, right? So we've seen the development of blockchain and how over the last decade it has become more and more mainstream and how it also was more and more regulated. Yeah, I think at the moment we also see massive regulations or trying to regulate and what's going on with the SEC at the moment and certain types of currency on the blockchain. And the regulation of Bitcoin, what was tried to be, you know, so there is massive dynamics. So how do you see Holochain when it would all, your vision, if it all would come as you just described, what kind of regulations would maybe try to be, you know, put on top of it?
How would it interact with our notion of state, for example? Like we talked a lot about how it's independent of state, but then is there some place where it still intersects, or is the idea of state still something that would be important, or not at all? Are we talking about a global peer-to-peer network of human beings without any state?
Yeah, I think that the tricky thing is that I think there's a few levels, layers, and stages to the answer of what you're talking about. For me, it boils down to one critical thing, though, which is that Holochain is designed to be what I call an unenclosable carrier. So all communication, all sense making, and all action, you could say, happens on carriers. So right now I'm pushing air through my vocal cords and shaping my mouth in funny ways to produce vibrations in the air. The air is now the carrier for sound, right? If you were in the room with me, we would have an unenclosable carrier in this shared space. So if you didn't like what I was saying, Mel, you couldn't grab the words and stop them from reaching Stephanie's ears, right? So that's what makes it an unenclosable carrier, in that everybody is on equal footing. And now we like look back somewhat nostalgically at indigenous cultures and look to the wisdom that they have around certain social patterns and relationships to nature and that kind of stuff. And I would assert that a lot of that has to do with the fact that they were oral cultures. They were organized around unenclosable carriers. Any abuse of power became very overt, right? The only way you can stop my words from reaching Stephanie's ears is by clapping your hand over my mouth, or clapping your hand over her ears, or shouting so loud as to drown them out. And everybody can tell that you're basically kind of abusing that power, right? But now if I'm dropping suggestions in the suggestion box at work, right? We have a whole lot of control factors going on behind that. Who knows which ones actually reach which people, right? And I don't think it's an accident that it's set up that way a lot of the time, right? But even just the act of writing the paper down, suppose we were all sitting around the fire, sitting around the campfire talking, then we have the scenario of the unenclosable carrier, right? But if I write a little love note and pass it across the circle, well, what stops you from replacing it or from throwing it in the fire or from just not passing it? Or it's now become enclosed, right? There are certain carriers that are enclosed and there are certain carriers that are not. And what I'm suggesting is that for this Cambrian explosion of new ways of organizing, new patterns of collective intelligence, we actually need an unenclosable carrier to encode our social agreements. That's what holochain is. Now, it's not to say that you can't set membranes, right? Like, there's only so far you can shout. Just because you're shouting in the air doesn't mean everybody on the planet can hear you, right? And you might be in a room where, you know, people outside can't hear or something like that. And so it's not to say that there aren't membranes and layers and shapes to unenclosable carriers, but it means that for those who are attached to that carrier, that are connected, everybody is on equal footing. Right? You don't have these sort of abuses of power of centralization, which happens when you have enclosable carriers.
Yeah, it's really it's a kind of a mind-boggling future that is almost difficult to imagine this without, you know, without being kind of rooted in our existing systems. But, you know, there's little glimmers of how completely transformative this kind of technology could be. I wonder, just kind of out of curiosity, you're working on all these things, and it's open source, but do you hold patents, or how do you feel about kind of the conflict between personal invention and this vision of kind of peer-to-peer freedom?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I personally lean toward open sharing and open source and all that kind of stuff. And I think especially in an information age, the idea that you could own an idea and prevent others from using it for an extended period of time is really hampering ourselves, hampering our collective intelligence. And so our IP policy, our intellectual property policy, is try to publish first, publish aggressively, like get the information out there in public domain so nobody can stop us from using our own ideas by patenting it. However, that being said, we created a software license. It's called the Cryptographic Autonomy License, and we got it actually approved through the open source initiative, you know, that approves open source licenses. It's an open source license, but it does have certain controls in it because this is new ground. This is distributed systems. And part of what the integrity of Holochain relies on is that you control your keys. And you basically control have the rights to your own data that you wrote to your source chain that you authored. And so the Cryptographic Autonomy License basically protects against people pretending this is a distributed app, but really they are generating the keys from seeds they control. And really they could go and transfer your money out of your account, or they could take control of you, or they could author things under your name as if, you know, take actions as if they were you and that kind of thing, which breaks down the agent-centric, breaks the integrity of the agent-centric model of Holochain. So the Cryptographic Autonomy License is designed, it's the first software license designed for peer-to-peer software. And that being said, sorry, back to your thing, we did apply for a couple of patents because we wanted enforcement on the license. Now, that doesn't mean we're not going to then share those patents openly, just like, you know, Tesla shared a bunch of their electric vehicle technology openly, even though they had patented those things. It just allows us to enforce the license differently. And we don't want people abusing this, you know, distributed software is a new kind of technology, and a lot of people don't know how to navigate it. And so we wanted actually some ability to enforce that you are in fact distributing the software properly and not really retaining central control.
You speak a lot about collective intelligence. We've come across this concept a lot, and even the analogy that we are one body, so to speak, and each of us has the DNA, carries the DNA for a new level of creativity. And I wonder if you could speak to how, this evolution, like, what's the value system behind, you know, what are we aiming for, or what are we, like, almost from a metaphysical perspective, what is your hope? You know, I really want the listeners to kind of get why this is so interesting. And it's not just not selling your data. There's something about this, the next step for humans.
What I'm concerned with is that there's different layers and levels of intelligence, right? The cells in our body, you could say, have particular types of intelligence encoded in them, right? And in fact, in many things, they seem smarter than us at certain things, right? At sharing resources, at making what they need out of what they have, at coordinating on large scale without centralized control. There's a bunch of things that our cells do better than us, for example. But the level of intelligence that we have is different, right? Like, we maybe can do calculus and cells probably can't. And, you know, we can build cars and cells probably can't. And, you know, and yet we are a collection of these cells in a way, right? But a new pattern of intelligence emerges at the level of the collective. It's a different encoding, a different level of intelligence. Same thing happens for our corporations, institutions, and governments, right? It is the form of that they are a type of social organism. And I don't say that in a flowery, poetic way. They literally spawn offspring. They have self-defense, like they protect their own survival. They have the pattern continues as the cells within them, people, are replaced, right? They perpetuate particular patterns of intelligence. If you get a CEO that has a notion that they want to take this oil company into a sustainable future, that's great. They're in this position of power until they start compromising quarterly profits, quarterly earnings. How long will they maintain the position of CEO, right? There's another level of encoding that will cause them to be kicked out, right? And that, so it's not about, we're really sloppy about this. And we think that these things are just aggregations of individuals. They're not. They actually encode different things. Like we talked about earlier, the state can't see you if you're not issued through a birth certificate or naturalized or a visitor via a passport, right? The state literally can't see you. It's a different level of intelligence. And I'm suggesting that most of the really show-stopping problems that we're confronting in the realm of, you know, climate change, acidic oceans, radioactivity, you know, loss of topsoil, like I can go on at like planetary system level problems that we're confronting. They are not a result of our actions as individuals, but our actions as collectives, because we've encoded these things into our currencies that drive these things that to be highly extractive. And that we've encoded cancer-like patterns. A corporation is a cancer that uses its resources to grow its wealth. We call that pattern in our body cancer, right? it's in the process of killing the host, just like cancer can kill the host, right? And so if we can't increase our ability to see and understand these patterns of organizing at the collective intelligence level, then we really can't solve the problems that we're confronting today. And currencies are a tool for this, holochain and, you know, other kinds of ways of encoding social agreements are tools for this. And for me, that's the game, is how can we actually increase, like, how can we get as good as the cells in our body are at doing some of those things, mm-hmm. right? Like at coordinating on large scale and sharing resources effectively and building what we need out of what we have, rather than like incenting hoarding and that kind of stuff, because really it's killing us and the planet.
You see, one thing I really took away from, I think, was for our audience who, as I think a lot of people are still discovering what is actually blockchain. I think in the last couple of years, the blockchain and sometimes also holochain has become sort of, you know, it's there, all of a sudden is there, it's in the mainstream advertisement, and then hence it is in our space. But do people really know about it? Mainstream? I don't think so. Not yet.
Right. And I think it's like, you know, it's very rare for someone to discern the difference between a blockchain, which is already kind of a new animal, to a holochain in our current state of awareness.
Right. But I think that it is very important for us to understand, and it's actually stuff everyone should understand, what is this new technology, because it offers us so many tools and options and stuff to play around before somebody sort of becomes in and regulates everything, or like takes out only part, or that takes only the profit part, in a way this would have happened with the internet, you know, sort of like centralizing the internet or commercializing it. And yes, it still serves us, but the potential of what the internet actually had is you know, maybe a little bit more limited. So I think that we should all understand it. This is where I find it's very, very important to have an episode with Arthur, because he talks about it in wonderful ways, like these visual images, which are easy to get into and to understand what, you know, how does a blockchain, what is blockchain, what is holochain, and then the intelligence stuff. And I love this example he gave with, you know, the consciousness that we have damaged our planet so much, and if it's not single people, it's a collective system.
Yeah, I think that probably one of the best points he made was that we as individuals really don't have the intelligence to solve some of the problems that we as a collective have created, or in various collectives, and that developing our collective intelligence, essentially creating new organisms to solve the problems that we've created. And it's really, to me, it's mind-blowing what he's opening up. It's an entire new universe of creativity and existence. But if we dial it back to, okay, well, what does it mean for us now? It means these little peer-to-peer networks that people can create are opening doors to us, and we should be able to distinguish between a high energy intensive blockchain application and this kind of lithe new DNA for creating connection and creating communications and creating new currencies. And this idea of redefining what currency is in our culture, like we think of it as exchange, but really it's just symbols of rules and protocols. I thought that was really important.
Yeah, or as he says, seize flow, you know. So that's
making flow visible.
Yes.
Conceiving of births and death as a flow, and birth certificates and death certificates as a kind of a representation of that flow. Thus, hence, it's a currency, right? And so if you start to look at currency that way, it's infinite how many ways you can design and think about currencies. And once you can do that, you can implement it in this computer network that that really will rocket launch our ability to create, I think, in the long run.
We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul.
Support us by rating this episode and sharing with all your friends.
And to learn more, join us at potofgold.world.
I'm Stephanie Overbach.
And I'm Mel Wymore. Thanks for listening.